All right, Representative Fritz. Right now, we can't move anything until we have a quorum, so why don't you start with your bill, and then once we get a quorum, we'll move it to just lay over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Fritz.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File Number 3520 is, again, we call it the SAMS bill. And it is
Representative Fritz?
Yes.
We have a quorum.
All right.
We're officially convened with the quorum, and we're going to lay House File 3520 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Fritz.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, House File Number 3520 is what we call the SAM bill, Self-Advocates in Minnesota. And the Self-Advocates in Minnesota is a network working group in Minnesota for people with developmental and mental health disabilities. And it was developed by self-advocates and allies in the state. Self-advocates were frustrated that self-advocacy received minimal funding and had no structure. They were frustrated because that was not a viable self-advocacy or there was not an organization for their activity. And I have with me today to further explain this legislation. And Rick Cardenas is here, and I'd like to turn it over to him.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Rick Cardenas, and I'm co-director at Advocating Change Together. And SAM, Self-Advocates Minnesota, is the overall self-advocacy network for Minnesota. We've been funded over the past 2-3 years, and this bill seeks to look for federal funding match, FFP, by some inadvertent way. It was not reaching, it was, we had it in our original 1032 from last year. However, when it got to do the transfer, that language was missing. So we're just adding this language as a separate bill to go on to 1032, which would seek those federal funds to see if we can find a match to expand this self-advocacy network.
Okay, very good. Are there any questions for the testifier or Representative Fritz? Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, I'm just curious, in this bill, why are we doing this just, and I mean, no offense at all to the organization itself, but I do wonder, as a matter of policy, why we're not doing this for other organizations on a competitive bid process or RFP process. Why are we going for federal grants just for this group?
Representative
Gottwald, well, they haven't come to me. All right, this is the only group that has really come to me for help in this area, and that would be my answer.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair and Representative Garfunkel, this is on top of a state grant, and I think that most funds that go to DHS would look for matching funds. HIF, given this language. So it's not a, I think they all should look for that also. Any funds that go to DHS, they should be seeking of a federal match throughout that entire department.
Okay, very good. Seeing no further questions, the bill has been laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Okay. Representative Rood. Representative Rood moves House File 3046. Recommend that it pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I do have some testifiers as well. House File 3046 is a bill to license birth centers in Minnesota. Birth centers are available in 33 out of 50 states. Currently in Minnesota, 3 birth centers are in the process of accreditation, with the Commission for the Accreditation of Birth Centers. This legislation would require that birth centers are licensed and obtain accreditation to establish a standard of care. And with that, okay. I do have an amendment, so I don't know if you want to move that or.
Sure. We'll amend it Representative Root moves the, is it the A1? The A1 amendment.
I believe so.
Why don't you briefly describe that and then we'll vote on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It lists birth centers as essential community providers. It also requires a report. The Commissioner of Health in consultation with the Commissioner of Human Services and representatives from licensed birth centers to evaluate the quality of care and outcomes for services provided in birth centers and to give that report back and evaluation back to the legislature. And it requires the commissioner to apply for any necessary waivers for CMS to allow birth centers and providers to be reimbursed. And Section 6 of the amendment, in negotiating managed care contracts, the Commissioner of Human Services shall take into consideration and the rates shall reflect the anticipated savings to MA by having patients use birth centers.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Root. Just in Section 6 and the prepaid health plans, we are directing the Commissioner of Human Services to do what exactly with the rates? Could you tell me? I'm just a little bit confused as to how these rates are going to be, how they're going to be calculated, number one, and number two, do we do this in other areas of the department?
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, this was a proposal in speaking with the Senate. Senator Berglund is the author in the Senate. There is an anticipated savings from birth centers. And what Senator Berglund wanted to make sure was as the state goes forward in negotiating contracts, that that is going to be reflected in the rates that they are negotiating for in the managed care contracts. She's saying, you know, we should be able to have this cost savings. It shouldn't cost us as much, and so we want that reflected when we're negotiating.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Root. The earlier language was worse than this, but this is essentially the Commissioner of Human Services setting rates on, once again, predicting savings that are not yet realized. I have some difficulty with price setting by any of our departments if that's what we're going with. So I do have difficulty with that. It's better than the earlier language, but it's still not a good idea as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, the rates will still need to be negotiated.
Okay, Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, one question that's gone through my mind on this proposal is, number one, who's going to be kind of inspecting for this license, this new certification or licensure, and then are we excluding anybody who currently, you know, are there entities now doing birthing that are not licensed as birthing centers who would have to jump through some additional hoops, go through some additional steps to do this? Are we excluding anybody?
Representative Ruud or anyone at the table?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gotham, I'm going to have one of my testifiers answer that. Yep.
State your name for the record.
Yep, my name is Amy Johnson Grass. I'm a licensed and certified professional midwife and owner of the Birth Center in St. Paul, who's currently operating. Right now, with this proposed legislation, the bill is being, you know, accredited through the Commission for the Accreditation of Birth Centers. In that process, you know, there are certain standards that need to be met. Part of those standards are site visits where a committee will come out and review all your policies and procedures, your records, you know, all of those things that are in place. So they are the accrediting body who's doing all of the site visits. Those standards then and all of that information is sent through the Department of Health for the actual license for the center itself. What this legislation and truly why we're here today is to set, you know, a uniform standard across the state. This is a growing trend here for Minnesota. You know, there's currently three birth centers in process. There's, you know, there's others in the works and getting talked about. This is setting a standard saying these are safety requirements, you know, to operate, to, you know, not only protect public safety, but make sure birth centers are operating appropriately. And it prevents anyone from going out and hanging a shingle and saying they're a birth center. And so. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Representative Gutwell.
Real quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. So I'm not, I'm, Are there places currently doing this or offering birthing center? And I also wonder, Mr. Chair, if there's any frequent flyer benefits under this for those of us who've had a lot of kids at birthing centers. That's a joke,
Mr. Chair. Not enough for you, but for your wife, maybe.
But are we, in fact, excluding anybody? Are there people who are no longer going to be able to do what they're doing now as a result of this?
No, currently we are the only birth center here that's up and running in the state of Minnesota. And then Cheryl Hyde Camp and there's another individual who are in the process of opening birth centers are following these guidelines, you know, in their process to become an open.
Could I make a comment too? Could I make a comment?
State your name for the.
Thank you. My name is Cheryl Hyde Camp, and I'm a certified nurse midwife in the Twin Cities area. And the current state of affairs is that anyone can open a birth center, given that licensure isn't required, regardless of their credentials or licensure status.
Okay. Representative Aver?
Well, thanks. And just to the bill and to some of the discussions swirling around here, there's currently anybody can have a birth in their home by pretty much anybody. As long as they disclose that they are trained in a certain way. The licensed traditional midwives have a very high credential, which is regulated under the Board of Medical Practice. Every country, pretty much, much of any exceptions, that has better birth outcomes than America has a lot of their uncomplicated births are done in uncomplicated ways in places that are in nice, friendly environments for the woman and her family or whoever wants to come around. And many of those are in homes. And this is just a way to help these women have a choice between the hospital environment, which is improved some extent than how it was being so stark and cold, with birthing, you know, wings and all that, and the, between that and the person's home, if they want a little more support and a little more, you know, in between, and so on. And I think it'll save some money, and I hope that the department can take that into consideration when they do figure the rates. And frankly, a better outcome birth is way less expensive and just far more satisfactory to all the parties. So yeah, good luck with the bill. It's a good bill.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Representative Rood. Do you have agreements with the hospitals then so that if you have a complicated birth, which I don't think can always be, many of those are unanticipated until toward the end. And so I'm wondering if there is some way that you have agreements or that you can coordinate so that you're not 2 hours away from a hospital and what happens in those issues where you run into things that you really can't handle.
Yes, I can't. Well, Ms. Johnson-Grass? Or
do you want to take it here? Go ahead. Sure. Mr. Chair, representatives, in a birth center, we work with low-risk women, so healthy pregnancy. You're right. Things may arise, you know, whether it be prenatally or during labor and delivery where it is, you know, more appropriate to be in hospital. You know, through the accreditation with the CABC, those, you know, guidelines and protocols and procedures are written, and each individual practice has relationships with either providers or hospitals in their area to make that, you know, to make that appropriate transfer. Within the accreditation guidelines as well, you know, it also talks about safe distances from hospitals. And so here in the Twin Cities, we're fortunate that, you know, facilities are very close by. And, you know, more in rural areas, that may change where, you know, we may be 10 minutes, where in a rural area, they may be 30 or more. So, but those are all within the CABC accreditation standards.
Representative Peterson?
Just a follow-up question. Do you then run the same risk of litigation, and do you have to carry the same kinds of insurance, et cetera, that doctors would, being practitioners in a birthing center? This is just curiosity on my part because I don't know enough about them.
Ms. Johnson Gray.
So, yes, with each profession, whether, you know, licensed midwives or certified nurse midwives or OBs, each profession within itself has different liability insurance and coverage that is available or that they may cover.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think just a comment. It's kind of exciting to see this bill come forward. My husband was the first father in delivery rooms at St. Cloud Hospital and two other hospitals. Matter of fact, we had a really fun time. The nuns put the champagne and glasses on ice for us in a very small hospital, so we really had a good time. It really does help you to relax. Highly recommend it. Nonetheless, I see this as your frequently asked questions do a nice job, I think, of addressing the concerns that I had and having read this ahead of time. And I think it just focuses again that having a baby is not a disease or a medical condition. Support and encouragement and other things like that, but certainly access when you need it, it becomes a medical condition. So I was glad to see that your questions and also the language of some of those things included addressing those concerns as I would have suspect we would. So are there any other opponents or concerns or things that you know of that you have not yet addressed in this language?
Mr. Root?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer. Thank you for your comments. No, we know of no opposition. We have been in discussion with ACOG, and at this point they are supported. They have some tweaks they want to be added to the study, which we're fine with that, but we're going to be working on language with that. So no opposition at this point.
I actually seen the Hospitals Association with one supporting the this bill. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what that is. But I think that through the recognition that their support to these birthing centers is a really important component, and it can help them save costs and focus their efforts on critical needs and other things like that. So it looks good. Thank you.
Rep. Lindy.
First of all, I think we're still on. Have we adapted the amendment, Mr. Chair?
No.
No, we have not adopted. We just kind of move on into discussing the full bill. We could move on to adopt the amendment right now. Okay. No further discussion on the amendment. All those in favor of the A1, I believe, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. No. Amendment is adopted. Okay, let's proceed to, unless we want to discuss the bill further. Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Root, I didn't see anything from the ACOG in the packet that's saying that they're in support of this bill, and it's a little surprising because I haven't heard from them. Do you have something that says that they are supporting this bill or will support it, or are they neutral, or because I know that they have been opposed to this bill?
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean. Let me phone a friend here. I'm sorry, Teresa. I was looking for their lobbyist. I don't see him in the room right now. But. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, on the fact sheet, in regards to the national organization supports birth centers, but we have met with some members from ACOG, from the Minnesota chapter as well. Oh, do you want to?
Welcome to the table. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Keel Gerard Associates. We represent ACOG, and we are working with Representative Rood for some tweaks, as she said, to try and get the bill in a position where we can be supportive.
Representative, good enough? All right. All right. Representative Rod.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if I'm reading the amendment right or not. I'm trying to find out on the fees section if that was filled in and if I missed something. I probably missed the fees that were put in. Yeah. I'm sorry, on page 3, lines 3.14. Mr. Chair.
Representative Root.
Yes, Representative Bott, yes, the fee section was filled in. Maybe I can ask Mr. Walls to help with that. I think it's at 316.
Mr. Walls.
365, I'm sorry, 365. Biennial 365. And is that on the amendment? I'm just trying to figure out where on the amendment.
It's in the bill. I think you're referring to the bill.
Am I in the wrong? Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Broad. I apologize. The Senate added that actually as an oral amendment.
Okay.
And that was, I could do that as well. We could insert it. It's 365.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative Root, I appreciate that. I think it would be good if you have the number that you're working with. Why don't we just align it here? I think that this probably is a place where it makes sense to do that.
Yes.
Okay.
That's great.
Did you want to move that?
No. I will. I would like to. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to amend. I don't have it in front of me, so if you can tell me the line and everything you want to read it, but 365 would be the amount to insert.
There's two places.
Is it this one?
Oh, thanks.
Can we get some advice from House Research?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rood, would the amount be the same for the temporary fee and for the biennial?
Yes.
Yeah, 365.
That's my understanding.
So on page 3, line 14, at the end of the line after the dollar sign, insert 365. And on page 3, line 15, after the dollar sign, insert 365.
Okay. I believe that's just an incorporation by Representative Root. So let's. Representative Root moves the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Okay. Yes, Representative Gatwal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Root, just real quickly, I understand in the amendment we are making these essential community providers. Can you explain to me why we're doing that?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Gottwald. That language would give the health plans an incentive to include birth centers in their provider networks or their enrollees, both private and public, because health plans generally use the same provider network for their private book of business as for their public.
Okay. All right. Anyone else from the audience who want to testify for or against this bill? Representative Dean?
Are we getting ready to vote? Is that the...
Well, we're probably going to vote on this, and it seems like we're probably going to... This bill will also be carried in the health finance provision omnibus bill as well. So,
I just had a couple questions for the
sure.
Author. One of the major concerns that I have with this bill is patient safety, which is obviously the reason that some of the providers have had difficulty with it in the past. And continue to have concerns and want to continue working on this. And one of the obvious reason for that is that there's no such thing as an uncomplicated birth. We want to be able to provide access. And when my kids in their hospital, one of the things that they promoted was that you could be from a delivery room into a crash C-section and have the baby out on the same floor in 5 minutes, and that our hospitals will see the disaster cases from these birth centers arriving at their emergency rooms and have to take on the liability, which I'm very concerned about. Our hospitals, we're already asking a lot of them as it is right now, and here we're going to be asking even more. One of the things that I understand from this bill is that it cannot be on the hospital grounds itself, that there has to be a separation. One of the things that I'm concerned about is that if there's a crash C-section, a breach, where their time is of the essence in getting these kids out, you can't have a C-section at these places. You have to have a C-section at a hospital. It can't be on the hospital grounds, so it can't be that close. Is there anything that says it's too far away, or it has to be 5 minutes away or 20 minutes away from getting a baby out in a breach situation, or there's other medical conditions that require uterine rupture, placenta previa, and other things that require immediate C-section or immediate surgery and transfusion. Can you talk a little bit about the safety of that?
Representative Root, anyone from the
Yeah, thank you.
Table?
First, I just want to say thank you, Representative Dean, and it's obvious you're married to a wonderful OBGYN. You have all the language down. And I think those concerns have been addressed in the standards. I'm going to turn it over, I think, to my testifiers to add a little bit more because they can give you some more information on that.
Just state your name before you proceed for the audio.
I'm Cheryl Heitkamp, and I'm planning to start a birth center in Minneapolis across the street from Abbott Northwestern Hospital. The accreditation documents require us to be within 30 minutes of a hospital. part of the nature of our skills as midwives and people who care for women during labor and childbirth is the training and the ability to recognize, because we attend with them during their entire labors, changes that mean that things aren't going very well, and having agreements with our facilities and ability to transfer people at the appropriate timing is very important to us, as well as we know to our consulting physicians and the receiving hospitals. So we are prohibited in our accreditation from what's called, what some people have called ER dumping. We have to make a transfer to a labor and delivery unit in consultation with a receiving physician, and we're very committed to making that a very smooth relationship for our clients and for the receiving facilities as well.
That's indeed.
And just one final comment. That kind of ties back to the we're saying that they can receive funds. We are establishing relationships with community networks to where we're going to give the hospitals a financial incentive to do this. But I'm also concerned that we are not properly educating the patients into the safeties and risks and advantages and disadvantages of that. And I hope that we do that as we move forward.
Okay. Representative
Root. Thank you, Representative Dean. And I guess what I would say to that is it does require informed consent. And it's not just, I think, giving hospitals an incentive. You said it would give hospitals incentive. There are many women who want to do this. And so really, I think it's going to be a matter of either you support birth centers that are licensed or you support birth centers that aren't, because we have nothing in our state that presents that prevents them from operating unlicensed at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give me some idea of ACOG and their tweaks or their concerns?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, at this point, the only tweak I know of speaks to the in the study section. They just want to be included on that panel, which we are fine with. But we also, I heard just actually I pulled off the House floor today. That was the first time we had heard that. That is not a problem. But I think the Hospital Association also may be included, so we want to draft some language in case there are other people that we should be including. So that's what we're working on.
All right. Representative Peterson, then we'll move to vote.
Well, just to relay two really quick, do you know what concern, you know, the hospital, Ms. Cook said that she was working with you in terms of the language. What remaining kinds of concerns do the hospitals have? That's one question. The second one is, I know that many of the hospitals, including the new Maple Grove, have a huge new kind of birthing area. Would you be able to work in those kinds of areas, or do you have to work in separate birthing centers? I mean, the birthing center as part of the hospital is kind of separate, but that would not be the kind of place that you would work in? So there's two questions. One, probably the concerns that are left from the hospitals, and then would you be able to work in those?
Ms. Stout?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Susan Stout. I represent the Minnesota Hospital Association. And our understanding is that for an affiliated or connected birthing center that is connected to a hospital, that would be a part of the license of the hospital. And sometimes the hospital calls may have a separate wing and have a birthing center connected to the hospital. It would still be allowed to do that. That doesn't come under this licensure. That would come under the hospital's licensure. Okay. These are for the freestandings. And we're not seeking additional language other than I think that if the study, the quality study that's in the amendment included hospitals, we think that would be a good idea. We'd like to be included in that, but we're not opposing the bill. We're supporting the bill at this point.
Thank you.
Very good. Seeing no further questions, all those in favor, well, Representative Rube moves House, renews her motion that House File 3046 be recommended, pass, and
as amended
and
returned.
And return to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carries. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Do we have a bill? Okay, next we have a discussion of the lengthy legality of counting supplemental security income. We have okay, we're going to go with Linda Goldboyle with the Welfare Rights Committee.
Hi, my name's Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. And I'm just going to give kind of a brief statement about how we feel about this issue. I know we're going to have some excellent legal testifiers coming up next. As far as the basics of the legality, it's obvious that the SSI money is given to a disabled person who's determined to be disabled by federal law. And that money is only supposed to be used for the person with a disability. So under the governor's proposal to count that SSI grant dollar for dollar against the rest of the family, we feel it's breaking federal law because essentially it's forcing the SSI money to be used for people for whom it was not intended. So that's kind of the basic bare bones legality of it. I have like four other quick points. And one is just kind of common sense. I mean, a lot of people who have disabilities in the family, who have disabled family members who are so disabled they get federal SSI, oftentimes are not able to work because of having to take care of that family member with the disability. So that forces those parents onto MFIP. And it's a catch-22 to then go ahead and cut those parents from MFIP. They're only on MFIP because of the disability in the family. The third point I'd like to make is we're just asking you to put yourself into the shoes of that disabled person who is already going to be facing a lifetime of difficulty and knowing that they have brought huge financial difficulty onto the rest of their families, all because of them, all because of their problem, which they can't help, yet they are to blame for drastically cutting the rest of the family's income. And the final point I'd like to make about the legality, which I know probably wasn't going to be addressed here, was the legality of taking money from the TANF fund, refinancing $29 million through this mechanism from the TANF fund to buy down the rest of the state budget, buy down a portion of the state budget deficit. This TANF money is supposed to be used for low-income families, and taking that money and punishing the poorest of the poor in the state who are already coping with disabilities in order to balance the state budget is completely, in my opinion, illegal and unfair. So that's all I have to say, and I certainly hope that the governor's proposal will be not listened to and not in any of the omnibus bills that come out of this body. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for the testify? All right. Next, we have Ms. O'Connor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Advocacy Director at the Legal Services Advocacy Project. And we were asked to come in today and to talk about the governor's proposal to deem SSI income against the MFIP grant. And with me today, I have Kathleen Davis, who is the supervising attorney of our government benefits unit from the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. And before turning it over to Kathleen, I just wanted to give the committee an idea of the type of family that is going to be impacted by this proposal. And I think that when the department arrives, they could perhaps, I know they have been looking at the families and have some new numbers that they could share with the committee. But this story that I'm going to tell you could be told 7,500 times, because that's the number of families impacted. With just the details of a diagnosis and the time spent being homeless would be a little different. The family I'm going to tell you about is a single mother of a preteen daughter. The mother used to work as a pediatric nurse. She was in a very abusive marriage. Her husband beat her, leaving her with severe head trauma. She was subsequently also diagnosed with schizophrenia. She lost her job. Her home in Washington County burned down. It was inadequately insured, and she and her daughter became homeless. The mother is now on SSI. She has been committed to inpatient psychiatric care 7 times in a little over 2 years. She and her daughter, after being served in transitional housing, are now in modestly priced market rate housing and have to live on a very tight budget. If her daughter loses her cash grant and food stamps grant, this family will inevitably become homeless again. And now I'm going to turn it over to Kathleen to tell you a little bit more about what we're looking at in terms of legal analysis.
David. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. My name is Kathleen Davis. I'm an attorney at Legal Aid. We have 3 major concerns at this point with the SSI bill. Number one, the government, we believe that it is highly likely that the governor's proposal to count SSI income against MFIP will violate the Federal Food Stamp Act. To implement the MFIP combined cash and food stamp program, Minnesota needed USDA approval. Negotiations went on for several years, and in 1997, the USDA did approve a waiver to implement the MFIP statewide. But only after it determined that DHS had complied with 2 requirements of the Food Stamp Act. The requirement that is relevant to this discussion is the requirement that the waiver and any successive modifications of the waiver, of which this would be, not cause a reduction of more than 20% in food stamp benefits for more than 5% of MFIP households. We believe that the governor's proposal will not comply with this requirement and thus violate the Food Stamp Act. We don't know for sure. Of course, we haven't seen analyses, but this is what we know. Minnesota already walks very close to this limit. In 2003, the legislature passed a law requiring a deduction of 125 of SSI counted against the MFIP grant. When the 520 analysis that DHS initially did and sent to the Department of Agriculture showed that Minnesota did not meet this test. And it's only by using different statistical analysis methods that the number was reduced below the 5% limit. The original number was approximately 5.7. With this proposal, DHS estimates that over 7,700 families will lose some benefits, and approximately 2,000 families would risk losing the total MFIP food stamp grant. On its face, these numbers raise a serious question whether the change will result in more than 5% families losing more than 20% of their food stamp grant. If the state does not meet this test, the waiver will not be approved by USDA, and the law, if implemented, will violate the Food Stamp Act. The second concern, we believe that the governor's proposal conflicts with a 1999 federal court district court case, VR versus Old, or O, I guess. And in that case, the court issued a preliminary injunction enjoining West Virginia's Department of Human Services from counting federal SSI benefits paid to children in determining the household's eligibility for their state TANF benefits. The court noted in that case that Congress, in enacting the SSI program, recognized that disabled children impose a greater financial burden on their families, and that the purpose of the SSI program was to assist these families in paying for expenses that were made necessary by their children's disabilities. The court found that counting SSI against the TANF grant was an obstacle to the execution of the full purpose and objectives of the SSI provisions. It also found that it was an obstacle to the congressional requirement that a representative payee use the SSI for the use and benefit of the disabled child. The third reason that we have a concern is we believe that the requirement of SSI being counted against the MFIP grant defeats the purpose of the MFIP program, which is to provide a financial assistance to low-income children. A major portion of these families have a parent who is disabled and receives the SSI. The MFIP is to provide for the children of that disabled parent. Disabled parents who receive Social Security disability benefits based on their work coverage and work record also receive a dependent child's benefit for their children. And the average benefit now for an adult on disability, Social Security disability, is $900 a month in addition with the additional payment for their children. However, the SSI program is a safety net program for very low-income persons who have not worked enough to get the Social Security disability or have never been able to work. Disabled parents on SSI do not receive a dependent grant for their children. Instead, MFIP is, in essence, the benefit available to these non-disabled dependent children. The governor's proposal totally eliminates this income for over 2,000 families and greatly reduces the amount for larger families. Similar policies have been rejected in other states. As the district court in VR stated, reducing or denying cash assistance benefits to the non-disabled family members of an SSI recipient increases the depth of these families' poverty significantly. For families with disabled children, it ignores the substantial costs associated with the disability and with the limited ability of these families to compensate for the loss of such income with increased earnings. For families with a disabled parent, it eliminates MFIP, the cash assistance that's now available to support non-disabled children in the family. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the for the testifier, Representative Abra?
Well, and I understood about half what you said, but thank you for saying it. You did good, but that's not my background. But how would reducing some money take them off, reduce their food stamps? Can you explain that part to me? How, if you count something, that makes them ineligible for some food stamps?
Yes, because the food stamps and the MFIP together are together in the Minnesota grant. So essentially, if you count the SSI dollar for dollar, let's say a household of two, they get $250 of cash and $178 of food stamps. So essentially, they would have no cash or food stamps. Now, they would be eligible for standalone food stamps. That is correct. But depending on some of their household expenses, for example, their housing expenses, they may have a greatly reduced amount of food stamps. The other thing is that the SSI recipient who now gets standalone food stamps is going to be combined into the house, so they will actually lose their food stamps. Now they will be compensated to some degree, but it is our position that when you look at everything, we feel that probably there will be enough people families or individuals losing food stamps that we will not meet the 520 analysis and not be able to get the waiver, which means that, and that's the thing that that's the legal approval that allows us to have the MFIP and the food stamps together.
Okay, good.
Chair.
Representative Hoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. I know that we've included SSI exclusions or calculate in the income for MFIP in the past, and that was did that violate federal law at that time?
At that time, what happened is that actually there was a lawsuit on this issue. What the Department of Human Services did not do is seek approval from the Department of Ag. And the lawsuit, the decision actually said that DHS must seek a modification. What happened in that situation with 125, it was a little below. It was, I think, 4.7. So, but initially when they did the figures, it was above 5%. And as I said, it's very complicated. It's not something I even want to begin to understand. But when they did some other statistical analysis, then they were able to reduce it below 5%, and then, in fact, the Department of Ag did approve it. And then I believe by that point, the legislature eliminated the 120 deduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back to this question, if it just slipped under that 5% threshold 4 or 5 years ago, whatever that was, what makes you think it'd be different this time around?
I think what makes it different is that we're talking about a dollar-for-dollar total grant issue here. I mean, at that point, it was a $125 reduction. This is a reduction dollar-for-dollar of the amount of SSI against the MFIP grant. The SSI amount right now is, for any person is $674. So for a family of two that now have $437 and a food portion of $327, I mean, essentially that means that they're pretty close to losing they've definitely lost their cash, and they will lose a significant portion of their food stamps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to belabor the point. Well, maybe not this point. Let's move to another point. Can you tell us, I mean, give me a makeup of a family that would have SSI. What challenges are they facing, or what situation are they in order to get SSI and MFIP benefits?
Well, it depends. I mean, for the child, a child who gets SSI has to meet the SSI disability standard, which means that they have to have marked impairment of function in two areas. Actually, the Congress in 1996 tightened the standard and made it fairly difficult to get disability as a child. The child has to be significantly impaired. It might be a physical disability. It might be a mental disability, it might be a combination. But these are kids that are significantly impaired. Otherwise, they don't get it. And in fact, you know, I represent kids in the SSI system, and you know, when we evaluate their whether they have a case that I could take, I mean, marked impairment is a high standard. And so it's significantly impaired. The adults, you know, you can have anything from a very severe, you may have someone on that has cancer, and because of the residual problems with the cancer or their ongoing treatment for more than a year, they might be considered disabled. Someone that has severe diabetes and has lost a limb. I mean, it's what it is for an adult is that they are so impaired that they aren't able to work. And the Social Security, again, is the one that determines that. They have a very complicated system. And it's based on medical evaluations. It's not, I mean, if you go to a hearing, your testimony about what you do every day is very important, but they look at the medical criteria, and if you don't meet it, they're not going to find you disabled.
Thank you.
Good. Representative Hayden, and then we'll have Chuck Johnson from the DHS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up a little bit with Representative Hosh's kind of characterization of what a family looks like, and I know we use terms like marked impairment or that maybe a parent may have cancer. Is there more of a description of what kind of typically you see, or do we know any of the categories of why parents are receiving SSI? Is it medical related, or is it developmental? Are there mental health issues? And I guess I don't know if you have that answer or not, because I think what I've seen is that it is typically one of those things where, like, the parent who is in charge of the kids maybe has the ability to run the family but doesn't quite have the ability to do that and to work at the same time because of their disability. And so that they need, you know, the SSI is providing a portion of what they would need that they would normally get if they were going out to work each and every day. So I'm trying to understand what that family looks like in terms of what their total dollars would be versus if that person was not on public assistance and was an able-bodied person to work and take care of their family.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that Chuck is going to probably testify to the composition a bit more of the families, in that the bulk of the families that will be affected by this have a disabled parent, and I think this is like 4,500 or 5,000 of the families have a disabled parent and children living in a household. And again, I think as Kathleen has testified, you know, the cases we see, the people that get SSI, you know, unless they have like a really clear-cut physical disability like cancer, which, you know, cancer. What we see a lot of is individuals who have both a physical and a mental disability. Much like the woman, you know, that I told you about, where she had severe head trauma, and then it resulted in a brain injury, which then resulted in schizophrenia. I mean, the other story I could tell you also involves somebody that has bipolar, severe depression, with diabetes. I mean, what we see is that a coupling of both physical and mental illness that rises to the level where Social Security, after an arduous process that takes up to 2 years, finds you disabled and unable to work. And so what I think is, these are some of the families, though, that are probably at most risk of homelessness if they lose a portion of their cash.
Good. We will have Mr. Johnson, Chuck Johnson from the department, to do his presentation, and then let's see if he could answer Representative Hayden's question. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Mr. Chair, what would be most helpful for me at this point to share with the committee? I'm not sure what would be helpful for you, right, given you've just testimony you've just heard.
Well, I guess just start you know, we're discussing the legality of counting the SSI benefit when determining the eligibility for MFIP. And I don't know if you, Representative Thiessen?
Isn't the question why is legal aid wrong?
What was that?
Isn't the question why is legal aid wrong?
Okay, that we could start with that. Mr. Johnson, is legal aid wrong?
Mr. Chair and members, I guess first to give you information on the impact and who the families are. There are about 7,700 families on MFIP. It's a little less than 20% of the families on MFIP who have a member receiving SSI. All those families would be impacted. 2,000 would lose assistance. 5,000 would lose their cash but potentially retain food. The others would lose some of their cash. There are about 9,700 or so individuals on MFIP receiving SSI. So there, of course, are cases where there are multiple people. It could be both parents. I guess it's a parent and a child. So that 9,700 people become 7,700 families, and that's the basic impact. Mr. Chair, I believe there are two issues that the folks from Legal Aid addressed. One of them has to do with the approval we need from the Food and Nutrition Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We have to meet a test under our waiver. It's called the 520 test, meaning that the changes we're putting in MFIP will impact that no more than 5% of the folks will lose 20% or more of their benefits under what they would have had under a non-waiver situation. We do believe that we'll meet that test with this proposal, largely because a number of the people who will lose assistance, lose cash assistance, and go to food would instead opt for the standalone food and as a result would not count against us in the 520 analysis. So that's the primary logic of why we believe we'll meet the 520. Whether or not we actually do is something we won't know until we sit down with USDA after there's passed policy in front of us and start to figure out what exactly they need from us in order to satisfy their threshold for this. And it's been a little bit different every time we've done it, so we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. This case being different again, yet again, because of the large number of cases that are impacted by actually being removed from assistance. The second issue that I believe was raised was related to the representative payee situation within the SSI program. That is a relatively new issue for us. We're in the process of evaluating that. It wasn't something that came up when we talked with the Social Security Administration initially when we were putting this proposal together. We are now seeking information from them on their view of this issue. And so right now I don't have a definitive answer I can give you on that.
What would happen if it was deemed illegal or we couldn't do what the governor proposed?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is potentially, it would depend on how we did this. I mean, if we understood ahead of time what the parameters were, what we could and couldn't do, it would potentially mean that we would, instead of having the policy apply to all cases that include both an adult and a child, we might have to set back to only having it affect cases that that include an adult and not the children because they're almost always underrepresented a payee. And that means that a certain amount of the savings that the governor has booked, something a little bit less than a third, we'd have that much less savings. We have only about two-thirds of what we have on the page right now. It is possible to look at other alternatives within that. I think it was discussed before there was a policy that was in place for 4 years between 2005 and 2008 that counted $125 of the SSI benefit. That was never challenged. Doesn't mean it wouldn't be necessarily challenged, but it wasn't. The implementation was challenged, I think, as was pointed out. But that had more to do with our timing of getting permission from USDA, not the substance of the policy itself. So that's, I think, probably what the impact would be. Obviously, if it got passed and then it was challenged, then we'd have the whole how things would play out through court, and that would be an unknown at this point as to how that would play out.
Representative Avery?
Well, thank you. Mr. Johnson, thanks. And I know that this is an interesting time for the budgets, to say the least. And you know, we always say it's the governor's budget, but I don't think he sat around your department and made up this thing, and maybe he knew about it or not. But so I'm just curious if you could, you know, hearing this testimony, it seems like there's some downsides to this. And when whoever talked about this, they must have been a round table thinking of ideas, and this one made it through some kind of a process. As it came out of that process, what was the discussion about the downsides that made it like seem like a good idea?
Commissioner Johnson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I think that has to be answered, I think, in a context where we had a significant target that we were trying to meet in order to help resolve the deficit. And I think those who were here when I testified on the parts of the budget that I'm responsible for know there isn't a major program within my area that we didn't put a big, didn't have a big reduction on. And so this wasn't like we picked out MFIP and decided let's, you know, go after the SSI. This was part of trying to, as I think I've told a number of people, this is the third time that we've made reductions for this biennium. There was a bill you all passed last year that had reductions for human services. The governor on a lot, and now we're on the third time around. Things get a lot deeper when you're on your third time around in the same two-year period and looking at options. So we had, with the target we had we couldn't not look at the MFIP grants as a place to go for potential savings. And when you're looking in the 20 to 30 million range, you can't do that without having some kind of negative impact on the families and children that are served by the program. What we were trying to do by looking at the SSI families is look at those families where there is other income in the family, where they have another place to go to help support, to pay the rent, to do other things. Obviously, this has a huge impact on those families, and I'm not sitting here trying to tell you that it's somehow minimal, but a lot of the other families we have are surviving with three people on $532 of cash, trying to somehow pay the rent and their incidentals along with the food money they get. And so it's, you know, it's difficult choices that you face when you get to looking at these kinds of options.
Okay, Representative Slavin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a child care question, and I think it's fair game because this committee, eventually we do child care when we join up with Representative Huntley's bill. As you know, Mr. Johnson, that as in, you also proposed counting SSI income benefits when determining eligibility for child care. So you took the same population, and then you're doing another issue with them. And sort of to Representative Abler's, you know, line of questioning, why would you go after the same folks and this time for child care assistance?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, well, in part, I think for the same reasons that we are trying to approach the budget target with and put as many options on the table as we can to look at, but also what one benefit of this proposal is that it does create an alignment across programs as to how we count SSI income, and it also aligns it with how we count Social Security disability income, which historically has always been counted in these cases, just SSI, which hasn't been, which has always been a point of contention with people who work in these programs. But it's in part that this proposal puts the MFIP program, the Child Care Assistance Program, and the Federal Food Stamp Program, called SNAP, which does count SSI, all on sort of the same footing as to how we treat SSI, creates a more simplified way of looking at income. So that clearly was one of the things that we were looking at when we were considering this. The savings from child care are quite a bit smaller because there aren't as many SSI individuals in the child care system, and because the it isn't likely to affect their eligibility as is maybe the amount of assistance they get, so the savings don't end up being as large. Most of the savings are in the MFIP area.
Okay. Reston Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Johnson. Along those same lines, we noticed, and even though we're not talking about this specifically, but we noticed that you refinanced $28 or $29 million of stimulus funds, air funds, that had come to the state potentially for folks that might not have a place to go if they become unemployed, and to be used for them. And it looks like that money is being refinanced into the general fund as well. So it appears that not only do we have the cut here, the dollar for dollar Social Security cut, but we also are taking $29 million into the state in the form of a hardship for people that might have to go on MFIB, and that is being refinanced as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, that is a proposal, yes. We can't do that without legislative approval, but that is the governor's proposal with the additional $28 million we have available to us. And frankly, that's money that isn't committed to do anything with right now. So it's a much easier place to go to get savings than is something like the proposal we're talking about, which actually impacts people who are currently receiving assistance.
Mr. Chair. So... So we're taking $28 million of money that you said that hasn't been appropriated, or your proposal, the governor's proposal, and to move that into the general fund, money that will send to the state for low-income people. And then in addition to that, you looked also at the population that actually is getting the money and are taking $28 or $29 million from them, at least this is the ideal around the round table, and then to put that in. And that is kind of where you're starting to find those large chunks of money on either deemed for people that are low income or actually for people that are low income that won't that won't get the money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hayden, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler, then we'll go to Representative
Peter. Well, thanks. And Mr. Johnson, I hope you recognize that you're the messenger and you just have to sit through these. And I can expect that you've had some pretty long nights thinking of this stuff. So, and the dialogue about cutting or raising revenue and all that has been fatiguing to me over a long time. Is there any idea about how this whole thing could be redesigned somehow to serve the people better and to target things and to consolidate some programs? And we're facing something in the order of $5 billion or $8 or however you count it coming up. And is your department, you know, if it's a secret, don't tell me that the final answer, but is there some thought between the advocates who come with some regularity here, I was in the Poverty Commission or whatever we called it, finding ways to do a better job. Is there some thought in your department about that so we can have less conversations like this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, certainly that's something that we're looking at as we go forward, understanding that the long-term issues with the budget are not changing and that we're not in a situation of sort of hoping things get better. I will say sometimes it's hard to have those conversations, though, when you're looking at, you know, a net zero or even a negative scenario. It becomes a very lonely time. It's not quite as crowded a room as it is when you're having the other kind of conversation. So getting the ideas on the table and getting engagement can be a little bit different when you're looking at a situation where you're trying to make things smaller but hopefully try to make it still work well versus the environment where you're expanding things.
Representative Tisa.
Thank you. So so under SSI, what's the average benefit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tyson, $674 a month.
Okay.
$674.
And then people on SSI, to qualify for that, they can't work, right? Is that generally?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tyson, I'm not an expert in SSI. I believe that there is some small window that's been created where people can work now under special projects. But generally speaking, I think that's true. And I think maybe the other folks here have a better idea.
Okay. And so, so the MFIP money goes to, you know, which is really welfare to work dollars, goes to this population. What's the reason that folks on SSI qualify for MFIP?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tyson, it's because there are multiple people in the family. Okay. And so what you have perhaps is a parent who may be on SSI, but the children don't have any other source of assistance, and that's where the MFIP comes in. Sometimes it can be the children, a child who's on SSI, and it can be the parents who are receiving MFIP. So it is kind of an odd combination where the MFIP program really isn't serving the work purpose that we think of, really serving more of a maintenance purpose for a population that, depending on which scenario you're looking at, isn't as likely to be working.
And with Mr. Chair, and with SSI, there's no, that's just for the person who's disabled. There's no benefits that go to their family members. And this is all questions that I don't know. This is not leading anywhere in particular. So, just so.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tyson, again, I think maybe the other folks have a better idea of how to address that. Certainly, where there's a representative payee agreement in place, I mean, like for a child, if my child is on SSI. My understanding is that those dollars are, I'm responsible for making sure those dollars are going for the good of the child. That may include some portion of the child's portion of whatever it costs to maintain the household, like the rent or whatever. But again,
I guess my question is, when you, with MFIP, if you qualify, you can qualify for just the individual, or you can qualify as a family in a sense, so that you get a bigger benefit if you're a family under MFIP. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tyson, if you apply for MFIP, you qualify. All the people who are eligible within that family unit for right. MFIP are part of MFIP.
But you get more money.
You get more as you have more people added.
But under SSI, you don't get more money. I guess that's the question I'm trying to get answered. You just get the amount for whoever the person that qualifies for SSI is.
Mr. Representative, that's correct. Each person gets $674. So if there's two people, then it's, I can't do the math that fast, but you can.
Okay. And so the argument that you're making is that as we look at all MFIP families, that there's this group that gets more money in a sense because someone qualifies, it can't work basically because of SSI. And choosing among those groups, you chose the folks that have this additional money.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Teason, that's accurate depiction, I think.
Okay.
Okay. We have Representative Slavik, and then we'll go Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Johnson, what Representative Abler brings up always makes me start to think here. We understand, you know, we're in a place with national health care reform passing and the jobs bill that there is going to be some significant financial changes for the better to this area. Will that cause the governor or you to possibly come out with a new proposal in this area?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik, I'm not aware of any plans for an update to the supplemental budget, but that doesn't necessarily mean it wouldn't happen in some form.
Mr. Johnson, part of me thinks of the level, and you were thinking about the proposals you had to come up with, as you mentioned, because you had to. And now that the scenario is not so bad, it seems like we'd appreciate your thinking on when it's not so bad what you would cut. And that's just food for thought. Obviously, you're not required to do that, but at some point, we may want to talk about that.
Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few areas. One of them is that when you are on SSI, my understanding is you still can work. It's just that there's two questions. One, are you able to work? And number two, how much income can you have before your SSI is affected or other benefits are affected? Is that not correct?
Mr. Johnson.
Ms. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I believe that's correct, yes, and that the counting against the SSI is one of the issues of going to work for people on SSI.
Yes, yeah, but I just wanted to be sure that we understand that just like in Social Security, there are usually ability to work and bring in some income that is supportive of that and just a matter of when it affects. And the other thing is on that, Mr. Chairman, that you mentioned there was an average of $674. Is there a minimum and a maximum dollar amount?
Mr. Chairman, Kiffmeyer, $674 is actually the maximum amount. It is what most people get, but if there is other income that could potentially get less than that.
One other question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the federal, my understanding of the federally appearing to be passed legislation, that the benefits of that and some of those things do not take effect. There is a time lag by which these benefits take effect. And so I think, you know, what we're looking at right now is a more immediate budget, whereas this is more something down the road. And so I think we have an immediate situation that we need to take care of that still requires that kind of thinking, though certainly going forward beyond that, there may be an adjustment. That would be correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
All right. Seeing no more questions from the members. We're gonna. For House File 3713, we're gonna move that for tomorrow's agenda because Representative Huntley is not here. So with that, we're gonna adjourn.